that little square box. All aboard, asked the captain. All aboard, sir, said the mate. Then stand by to let her go. It was 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning. Everything was prepared for a start. The whistle had sounded twice. The final bell had rung. The bow was turned toward England, and all was ready for Spartan's run of 3,000 miles. Time is up, said the captain, closing his chronometer and putting it in his pocket. Suddenly, there was a shout from the bridge, and two men appeared, running very quickly down the quay. It was clear they were hurrying to the ship and wanted to stop her. Look sharp, shouted the people on the quay. Ease her, stop her, cried the captain. The two men jumped aboard at the last moment, and the ship left the shore quickly. The people on the quay shouted with excitement. So did the passengers. They were all glad that the two men had got on. I went round the deck, looking at the faces of my fellow passengers. I found nothing interesting. 20 types of young Americans going to Europe. A few respectable middle-aged couples. Some young ladies. I turned away from them and looked back at the shores of America. I wanted to be alone. So I found a place behind a pile of suitcases and sat down on a coil of rope. I enjoyed being alone. A few minutes passed. Then I heard a whisper behind me. Here's a quiet place, said a voice. Sit down, and we can talk it over. Nobody can overhear us here. The pile of suitcases was between the men and myself. Looking through a chink between the big suitcases, I saw that they were the passengers who had joined us at the last moment. I was sure they did not see me. The one who had spoken was a tall, thin man, with a blue-black beard and a colourless face. His companion was a short fellow. He had a cigar in his mouth, and a coat hung over his arm. They both looked around them as if they were afraid that they were being watched. This is just the place, I heard the other say. They sat down, and their backs were turned towards me. I found myself, against my wish, playing an unpleasant part of eavesdropper. Well, Muller, said the taller of the two, we've brought it aboard all right. Yes, agreed the man whom he had addressed as Muller. It's safe aboard. But we were running a terrible risk. Yes, we were, Flanagan, said Muller. It would have been horrible if we had missed the ship, said Flanagan. Yes, it would, said Muller. It would have upset our plans. For some time, the little man smoked his cigar in silence. I have got it here, he said at last. Let me see it, said Flanagan. Is no one looking? Asked Muller. No, they are all below. We must be very careful, of course, said Muller. He raised the coat that was hanging over his left arm, and I saw a dark box which he had laid on the deck. One look at it was enough to make me jump to my feet in horror. If they had turned their heads, they would have seen my pale face looking at them over the pile of suitcases. From the first moment of their conversation, I had a horrible feeling of danger. Now I was sure that I was right. I looked hard at what lay before me. It was a little square box of some dark wood. It looked like a pistol case, only it was much higher. There was a trigger-like arrangement on the lid of the box, and a coil of string was tied to it. Near the trigger was a small square hole in the wood. The tall man, Flanagan, as his companion had called him, looked through the hole for several minutes. It seems all right, he said at last. I tried not to shake it, said the companion. One must be very careful with such things, but in what's necessary, said Flanagan. Then the shorter man took from his pocket a small paper package, opened it, took out some white granules, and dropped them through the hole. A funny clicking noise was heard from the box. Both men smiled. They were pleased. Everything seems all right there, said Flanagan. Yes, everything is going fine, answered his companion. Look out, there's someone coming. Take it down to our berth. Nobody should know what our plans are. It will be very bad for us if anybody finds out about them, and it will be still worse if anyone pulls the trigger by mistake. He will be terribly shocked, said the taller man with a laugh. It's not badly done, eh? Is it your own design? Asked Muller. Yes, it is, was the answer. We should take out a patent. And the two men laughed again with a cold laugh as they took up the little box and put it under Muller's coat. "Let's go down and hide it in our berth," said Flanagan. "We shall not need it until tonight, and it will be safe there." His companion agreed. They went arm in arm along the deck. The last words I heard from Flanagan, who was telling Muller to carry the box carefully and not to knock it against the sides of the ship. How long I stayed there, sitting on the coil of rope, I do not remember. I was shaken by the words which I had overheard. Everything seemed to fit in perfectly well. The two passengers' suitcases were not examined because they had come aboard in a hurry. Their strange manner and secret whispering, the little square box with the trigger, their joke about the shock of the man who had let it off by mistake, all these facts led me to believe that they were terrorists. They had bought an infernal machine on board, and they were going to blow up the ship. I was sure that the white granules which one of them had dropped into the box formed a fuse for blowing it up. They said something about tonight. Was it possible that they were going to carry out their horrible plans on the first evening of our voyage? What shall I do? Shall I go to the captain and tell him about my fears, and put the matter into his hands? The idea was very unpleasant to me. What would be my feelings if it turned out to be a mistake? Anything was better than such a mistake. No, I won't go to the captain. I shall keep an eye on the two men and tell nobody about them. I decided to go down and find them. Suddenly I heard someone shouting in my ear. "Hello, is that you, Hammond?" "Oh," I said as I turned around. "It's Dick Merton. How are you, old man?" This was good luck. Dick was just the man I wanted, strong and clever and full of energy. Ever since I was a small boy in the second form at Harrow, Dick had been my advisor and protector. He saw at once that something was wrong with me. "Hello," he said in a friendly way. "What's the matter with you, Hammond? You look as white as a sheet. Feeling seasick?" "No, no," I said. "Something quite different. Walk up and down with me. Dick, I want to speak to you. Give me your arm." We started walking up and down the deck, but it was some time before I could begin speaking. "Have a cigar," he said, breaking the silence. "No, thank you," I said. "Dick, we shall all be dead men tonight." "Is that why you don't want a cigar?" asked Dick calmly. But he was looking hard at me when he spoke. It seemed to me he thought that I was a little mad. "No," I said, "there is nothing funny here, and I am quite serious. Dick, I've discovered a conspiracy to blow up the ship and everybody on board." And then I told him everything I knew. "There, Dick," I said as I finished, "what do you think of that?" To my surprise, he began laughing. "I would have been frightened if I had heard it from anybody else," he said. "But you, Hammond, have always liked to discover strange things and make up stories about them. Do you remember at school how you told us there was a ghost in the corridor? We soon found out it was your own reflection in the mirror. Why, man," he continued, "why would anyone want to blow up the ship? Why would these two men want to kill the passengers and themselves too? I'm sure that you have mistaken a camera or something like it for an infernal machine." "Nothing of the sort," I said rather coldly. "I know what I'm talking about. As to the box, I have never before seen one like it. They would not have carried it so carefully if it had been only a camera. They were afraid to drop it because there was something dangerous in it. Let's go down to the saloon and have a bottle of wine. You can point out these two men if they are there." "All right," I answered. "I'm not going to lose sight of them all day. Don't stare at them, because I don't want them to think that they are being watched." "All right," said Dick, "I won't." When we came down to the saloon, a good many passengers were there, but I did not see my men. We passed down the room and looked carefully at every berth. They were not there. Then we entered the smoking room. Muller and Flanagan were there. They were both drinking, and a pile of cards lay on the table. They were playing cards as we entered. The conspirators paid no attention to us at all. We sat down and watched them. There was silence in the smoking room for some time. Then Muller turned towards me. "Can you tell me, sir," he said, "when this shit will be heard of again?" They were both looking at me. I tried not to show them how nervous I was. "I think, sir," I answered, "that it will be heard of when it enters Queenstown Harbour." "Ha-ha," laughed the angry little man. "I knew you would say that. Don't push me under the table, Flanagan. I don't like it. I know what I'm doing. You are wrong, sir," he continued, turning to me. "Quite wrong." "The weather is fine," I said. "Why should we not be heard of at Queenstown?" "I didn't say that," the man answered. "I only wanted to say that we should be heard of at some other place first." Where then? Asked Dick. That you will never know, said Muller. But before the day is over, some mysterious event will signal our whereabouts. Ha ha! And he laughed again. Come on deck, said his companion angrily. You have drunk too much, and now you are talking too much. Come away. Taking him by the arm, he led him out of the smoking room and up to the deck. Well, what do you think of it? I cried as I turned towards Dick. He was quite calm as usual. Think, he said. Why, I think that his companion thinks that we have been listening to the silly talk of a half-drunken man. The fellow can't be responsible for his words. Oh, Dick, Dick, I cried. How can you be so blind? Don't you see that their every word shows that I am right? Nonsense, man, said Dick. You are too nervous, that's all. And how do you understand all that nonsense about a mysterious event which will signal our whereabouts? I'll tell you what he meant, Dick, I said. He meant that some fishermen near the American shore would see a sudden flash and smoke far out to sea. That's what he meant. I didn't think you were such a fool, Hammond, said Dick, Merton angrily. Let's go on deck. You need some fresh air, I think. When it was time to have dinner, I could hardly eat anything. I was sitting at the table, listening to the talk which was going on around me. I was glad to see that Flanagan was sitting almost in front of me. He drank wine. A few passengers sat between him and his friend Muller. Muller ate little and seemed nervous and restless. Then our captain stood up. Ladies and gentlemen, he said, I hope that you'll all make yourselves at home aboard my ship. A bottle of champagne, steward. Here's to our safe arrival in Europe. I hope our friends in America will hear of us in 8 or 9 days. Flanagan and Muller looked at each other with a wicked smile. May I ask, Captain, I said loudly, what do you think of Fenian manifestos and their terroristic acts? Oh, Captain, said an old lady, do you think that they would really blow up a ship? Of course they would if they could, said the Captain, but I am quite sure that they would never blow up mine. I hope you've given orders to make it impossible for them, said an old man at the end of the table. All goods sent aboard the ship are carefully examined, said the Captain. But a passenger may bring dynamite aboard with him, I said. I'm sure they would not want to risk their lives in that way, said the captain. During this conversation, Flanagan didn't show any interest, but he raised now his head and looked at the captain. Don't you know, he said, that every secret society has some very brave men? Why can't the Fenians have them too? There are many men who are ready to die for that idea, which seems right in their eyes, though others may think it wrong. Murder cannot be right in anybody's eyes, said a passenger. The bombardment of Paris by the Germans was nothing else, said Flanagan, but the whole world paid very little attention to it. Only the unpleasant word murder has changed into the more pleasant one of war. It seemed right enough to German eyes. Why can't dynamite seem right to the Fenian? We had better change the subject of our conversation, said the captain, or the ladies may have a restless night. I drank off 2 or 3 glasses of wine, and then I went up on deck. Well, I thought, as I looked at the beautiful night around me, if the worst comes to the worst, it is better to die here than to wait for death in agony at a sickbed on land. As I turned my head, I saw 2 figures, now well known to me, at the other side of the deck. They were talking, but I could not hear a word. I decided to hide in one of the lifeboats. It was dark now. So dark that I could hardly see the figures of Flanagan and Muller. A few passengers were still on deck, but many had gone below. Another 30 minutes passed. It was getting more and more nervous. Then I saw that the 2 men had crossed from the other side and were standing rather near me now. I saw that Muller had the coat hanging over his arm. All I could do was to lie in the lifeboat and call myself a fool for not telling the captain all about it. Then I heard their whispered talk. This place will do, said a voice. Yes, it will. Are you sure the trigger will act? Yes, I'm sure it will. We were to let it off at 10, were we not? Yes, at 10 sharp. We have 8 minutes left. There was a pause. Then the voice began. I'm afraid they will hear the clicking of the trigger. It doesn't matter. It will be too late for anyone to do anything. How slowly time has passed. It will make a sensation on land, said a voice. Yes, it will make a noise in the newspapers. I raised my head and looked over the side of the boat. There was no hope, no help. Death stared me in the face, and I could not do anything. There was nobody on deck except these two dark figures. Flanagan was holding a watch in his hand. 3 minutes more, he said. Put the box down on the deck. It was a little square box. I looked over again. Flanagan was shaking something out of paper into his hand. I saw the white granules, the same I had seen in the morning. I was sure they would be used as a fuse. He dropped them into the little box through the hole. I heard the same strange noise which I had heard before. A minute and a half more, he said. Shall I pull the string, or will you do it? I shall pull it, said Muller. I could stand it no longer. Stop, I screamed, jumping up to my feet. Stop it at once. I was brave enough now. Why do you want to have the blood of 200 people upon your hands? He's mad, said Flanagan. Time's up. Pull the string, Muller. I jumped onto the deck. You shan't do it, I cried. What right do you have to stop us? It's no business of yours. Get away from this. Never, I said. We can't lose a moment now. Time is up. I'll hold him, Muller, while you pull the trigger. Next moment I was struggling with Flanagan. It was useless. I was a child in his hands. He pushed me against the side of the ship and held me there. Now, he said, he's helpless. He can't do anything. Hurry up, Muller. I felt that it was time to prepare myself for death. I saw Muller come up to the box and pull the string. There came a strange clicking noise from the box. The trigger fell. The side of the box dropped and let off two grey carrier pigeons. Little more can be said. Perhaps the best thing I can do is to keep silent and let the sporting correspondent of the New York Herald explain everything. Here is what he wrote in his article soon after our ship had left America. An interesting match of pigeon flying took place last week between the pigeons of John H. Flanagan of Boston and Jeremiah Muller of Lowell. The start was from the deck of the transatlantic steamship Spartan at 10 o'clock on the evening of starting from New York. The distance between the ship and the land was about 100 miles. The match and preparations for it were kept secret, as some captains do not allow sporting matches to take place aboard their ships. There was some little difficulty at the last moment, but the match began almost on time. Muller's pigeon won as it arrived in Lowell on the following morning. What happened to Flanagan's bird, we do not know. We hope that a few such matches will make pigeon flying more popular in America.